I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Welcome back to the Bulwark Coast of Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm the culture editor at the Bulwark. I am very pleased to be joined today by Will Haygood, who is the author of Colorization, 100 Years of Black Films in a White World. He is the author, the prize-winning historian, biographer, and journalist, and author of Tigerland, which won the Ohio Anna Book Award and was named runner-up for the Dayton International Peace Prize. Showdown won the Scribes Book Award and was a finalist for an NAACP Image Award. And you are also the author of The Butler, which was made into a film directed by Lee Daniels and starred Forrest Whitaker, Oprah Winfrey, Jane Fonda, and Vanessa Redgrave. So very, very pleased to have you on to talk about colorization and the world of Hollywood in general. Thanks for being on the show.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
So the first thing we should start at the beginning, and your book essentially starts with The Birth of a Nation, which I think a lot of film historians peg as the birth of kind of modern American cinema, and in a way is the kind of original sin of Hollywood and when it comes to race. Let's talk about that movie and its prominence both in the Woodrow Wilson White House and in the culture at large.
Yes, great. It was a movie that grew out of a novel written by Thomas Dixon. And the novel was called The Klansman. It's interesting because Thomas Dixon had gone to Johns Hopkins University, and one of his classmates was none other than the young Woodrow Wilson. Mm-hmm. And so years roll on, Woodrow Wilson becomes the governor of New Jersey and then runs for the White House and wins. And this novel gets a lot of attention, especially in the Deep South, all throughout the South. It was a novel written by a Southern sympathizer, Mr. Dixon, whose father had fought in the Civil War. So it was one of those lost cause novels where white Klansmen were heroes and every black was a villain. And so Thomas Dixon goes to the White House, meets Woodrow Wilson again. He tells the president that his novel has been adapted into a movie and directed by one of the giants of Hollywood at the time, Mr. D.W. Griffith. And the movie opens and it becomes a sensation. It's a very racist movie. It ignites outrage amongst blacks all around the country. They stage protests, and the movie has a showing at the White House. So that really fastens the movie into a very sort of important dynamic. Mm-hmm. This movie had a premiere at the White House,
yeah,
the Citadel of American power. And the movie played for four straight years, and it was the first film that really ignited civil protest in this country on a massive scale.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because this is a topic that kind of comes up again and again in your book, is that, you know, people were out protesting this movie, which only raised its profile, which,
right,
you know, it caused controversy, which which encouraged folks to go see it because they're like, oh, what's this movie everybody's talking about? And you see this again. You see this in The Homesteader, Oscar Michaud's movie that we'll talk about in a moment here, but also with Sweetback's Badass Song, and even Do the Right Thing. I mean, it's a really interesting dynamic. To put too blunt a point on it, do you think it was a good thing or a bad thing to protest the movie like this? I mean, do you think it just caused more attention to come to it, or was it so horrifyingly racist that it was worthy of just signaling how much it disturbed people?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you were Black, it definitely was a film that you had to go out and raise your voice against. Maybe whites looked at it whereas, yes, it's only raising the movie's profile, but if you were Black being beaten down every day, socially and politically and economically and nearly spiritually in a country where you still were not anywhere near a full citizen, it was definitely worthwhile protesting. I mean, because many people sort of judge Black people from what they saw on the movie screen. I mean, it was a very segregated nation. So it wasn't like every white person knew somebody Black. Mm-hmm. I mean, very segregated. So Blacks really didn't normally live in neighborhoods that were mostly white. I mean, it's a very segregated nation. And so this movie was very harmful to Black pride, Black sensibility. And so, yes, as they say, what do they say? You know that phrase, no publicity.
Yeah, is sure. Horrible. No publicity is bad publicity, right?
Yeah. You know, but the movie became kind of like a movement, you know, to stand up for your dignity and your rights.
Yeah. I mean, it really is interesting to look at this because, I mean, I'm reading your book and in it you talk about how it actually changed the business of showing movies just in general. I mean, here's a line from your book. The Birth of a Nation even helped change the dynamics of how America went to the movies. Theater owners began keeping theaters open with longer hours. They started realizing more than ever the profitability of snacks at their concession stands. And you conclude your point here by saying it seemed as if Blacks had one more enemy, cinema, which, I mean, is like a very, again, it's a striking way to start this story of modern American filmmaking.
Yes, I think it was important to start the book this way because cinema was new. It was like the moment that somebody had their ride in their first car in the 20s. That sensation would be new. You would hold on to that sensation. So if you went and saw this movie on a big wide screen, and it did have a whole lot of technical wizardry that other movies didn't have. Split screen, had all kind of jump cuts, and it had Woodrow Wilson's prose intercut into the movie. Mm-hmm. So words that he had written before he got to the White House were subtitles of this movie. And so it almost made it seem like the US government had sanctioned this movie because Woodrow Wilson was in the White House and his name was on the screen in this movie portrayed Blacks as thieves, murderers, and rapists. Mm. And the movie played for 4 years around the country. So it was very devastating for Blacks.
Yeah.
There were many whites too. You know, there were many whites too who marched with Blacks and mm-hmm. who stood outside of these theaters trying to stop the movie from being shown. Some people too to your point, did think, okay, if we stop this movie, is this not censorship? Is this not censorship? So that was an important frame of thought that also was out there.
Yeah.
And that we talked about.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like, you know, more things change, et cetera. I feel like we're still having this argument today. I want to talk about, please correct me if I'm pronouncing his name incorrectly, but Oscar Michaud, is that?
You're correct.
Okay, you're good. But he, when I emailed you about your book, I said I learned more reading this book than I have in most of the books that I read for this podcast, because I knew nothing about Oscar Michaud, for instance. Mm-hmm. And he's a really interesting figure. Let's talk about him as kind of the first Black American filmmaker. I mean, it's a really interesting story. What was his deal, and how did he kind of change or not change the face of American filmmaking?
Yes, he was just very brave. I mean, he was born in the Midwest, and after high school, wanted to venture out, and so he went west. He landed in, of all places, South Dakota. He went out there on the Homestead Act, which was passed by Lincoln. And it was President Lincoln who passed the Homestead Act. And it was really for pioneers, people who wanted to go out west to settle the land. And then the US government would say to you, if you stay on this land for 2 years or 3 years or 4 years and you help us settle the West, you move out there and you become part of this city or this town, then we will allow you to have that land. And so he was a pioneer in the true sense of a word. He gets out there, he starts farming, he does okay, he's bored at night, he starts to write stories about being the only Black man out there farming as far as he could see. And he made friends, white farmers and men and women. But these books told the story of his life. And so he had heard about this very devastating film, The Birth of a Nation. Mm-hmm. Oscar Michaud gets it in his mind, well, hey, I'm Black. I'm very prideful about my people. And I've come out west. I've helped settle the West. And maybe I can find someone to help finance an idea of mine, which is to write a script and have my autobiographies turned into film. And so he had a hard time of it at first, but then he started raising money. He started selling more of his books. He saved that money and he started filming his short stories, which really, really was amazing. And then he started turning these short stories into longer films. And then he would go to big cities. He would go to Chicago and New York, and he would talk to theater owners and he would tell them his story. Hey, I lived out west. I wrote this book. I wrote the screenplay and I filmed it. And so I have a movie in the trunk of my car that I would like to start showing. And yeah. So he did this for years and years and years, and he would just show his movie. I mean, he must have been a strange sight, a Black man who did not have any links to Hollywood, mind you, Sonny. There were no links to Hollywood. He just said, well, Hollywood doesn't care about me, doesn't care about my people, so I'm gonna do my own thing, which he did. And he really became the first godfather of Black cinema.
It's a really amazing story. Again, I strongly recommend people pick up the book again, which is called Colorization. It's by Will Haygood. You can find it on Amazon. It's wonderful. Definitely check it out. One thing that's interesting, and I just had never thought about it because it had never occurred to me, but you know, in the early years of cinema, we're talking about still a very segregated country, still a very segregated business. How did segregation hamper and hinder the efforts to not only get these movies distributed, but also just seen by folks? I mean, if you have white cinemas and black cinemas, I mean, it's a very, it's fraught.
Yes, 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 it certainly is. He was very smart. He would go to black newspapers and black newspaper men and black newspaper women, and he would have them write stories about his odd journey, his strange life. Black filmmaker, those two words weren't really heard a lot in American life. And so, yes, he was forced to stay inside of a segregated world, but there was a thriving black community in this nation, town to town to town. And there were blacks who had made money. There were blacks who had supported black causes. There was the NAACP. And there were social groups. And of course, there was a great love of the arts. Oscar Michaud was thriving during the Harlem Renaissance, in the 1930s. You know, he knew writers, he knew poets, and those people knew him. And so it just really started to snowball, and it built and built and built. And he gave other people inspiration to look into the film business, and it just started to grow.
Yeah. I really fascinating guy. Everybody should read up on him. Are any of his movies still in circulation? Can any of them be seen still, or have they all been lost?
Yes, some have been lost. There's a fairly good amount of his movies that have been lost, but there have been some that have been saved. I mean, he had a fascinating eye for talent. He cast Paul Robeson in a movie. Mm-hmm. And he knew how to find talent in Hollywood. Most black actresses, if not all black actresses, had roles as maids. It was Oscar Michaud who first gave black actresses roles that were far more varied than just playing a maid. School teachers and nurses and secretaries and business owners, all this was new. It was really like he was introducing black life to white America via the major motion picture screen. Mm-hmm. You know, when the whites would go and see his movies, you know, and whites did go and see his movies. Some people just wanted to go to a film on a Friday or Saturday night. Maybe they go up into Harlem to see his movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's crazy. So let's move ahead a few years and talk a little bit about Gone with the Wind, which again is another very controversial movie. Hattie McDaniel wins Oscar for Best Supporting Actress, but that you know had its own controversial element in the black community. I mean, I'm curious to get I'm curious to have you talk a little bit about how her career kind of either evolved or stalled out after Gone with the Wind, and also the reaction that people in the black community had to her performance, and just the idea of the mammy role in general.
Yes, well, let's start with the author of that book, Miss Margaret Mitchell. She was born in the South, and she went east to Smith College, and And she saw Black students there on that campus, and she was rattled by that. So she left school and ran home. And she wanted to write, so she starts writing this big antebellum novel about a family and their Black maid in the novel. And the novel came out. It was a big sensation, big, fat, juicy novel. And the Black maid was named Mammy. It wasn't even a first or last name, just Mammy. So the movie has a stunning cast, has Clark Gable, has Vivian Leigh, has other stars of the era. And it becomes a sensation because the book was a sensation. Mm. And it comes out, and there is a world premiere of this movie in Atlanta. Hattie McDaniel is told to not come. It's a Southern, very segregated city. So she doesn't come to the premiere. She's hurt by that. But this is very, very interesting. There is a Black choir, a Black church choir that comes out to one of the festivities for the movie rollout the night before the premiere. And this Black choir from a local church has a little kid singing in the choir. That little kid is Martin Luther King Jr. Mm-hmm. He's in the little choir that day. So anyway, Margaret Mitchell has a Black maid. I mean, this is very interesting to me. Her maid gets sick, and Margaret Mitchell is very close to her maid, and she takes her around the hospitals trying to get her a bed and help. No hospital would take her. And the Black maid has to go back home, and she dies for lack of medical care. Margaret Mitchell was very stunned by this. It was as if it snapped her out of the world that she had lived in. And she wrote to Morehouse College and said, hey, I'd like to give some money to start training Black men and women to enter the field of medicine. Yeah. And she did, although she didn't want that news spread around town. She thought that she might lose friendships if other whites thought that she was helping Blacks train in the field of medicine. Getting to Hattie McDaniel, she appeared in that role. She won an Oscar. It was a hard pill to swallow for many Blacks because it was a very stereotypical role. And she did play that stereotypical role to the hilt, but her Oscar didn't help her. And with other roles, she sort of stayed in that field of mammy roles. And she died still playing maid roles. And that's the story.
It's a sad story, but it leads. I wanted to talk a little bit about James Edwards, who's one of the first Black actors to kind of break out of stereotype roles and show somebody with a little bit more depth to him, I think, in terms of white, at least from the perspective of white filmmakers. Who was James Edwards, and what was so special about Home of the Brave that kind of struck a chord, not just with white audiences, but also black audiences and black actors.
Yes. He was born in the Midwest. He went to Knoxville College. He studied drama. He wanted to be a boxer in life. He went out on the road. He was boxing for a few years, very tough life. He really wasn't that good. And so he went to New York and he appeared in several plays. He was really good. People who saw him told him, you definitely ought to go to LA. Definitely ought to try to break into film. He went to LA. He found it very hard to break into film. He was a black man. He was very handsome. Stanley Kramer was a producer. Stanley Kramer had saw a play on Broadway called Home of the Brave. It was about a soldier who happened to be Jewish, who was fighting racism in the war. Stanley Kramer came up with this idea, and I think I'll take Private Moss, who is the soldier, and I really think I'll make him black in a new version of this screenplay. And so Stanley Kramer was looking for an actor who could play the role of a soldier in World War II who has to deal with racist fellow soldiers. So he was going to put a black soldier at the center of this story that he starts filming in 1949. Mm-hmm. Stanley Kramer was so nervous, though, and his team was so nervous that they didn't tell the studio until they were almost finished filming that they had recast the role. And it wasn't for a soldier who was white and Jewish. It was for a soldier who was black. And it was the first starring role for James Edwards. The movie comes out, gets a lot of great reviews. Everybody is looking at the screen, walking out of the theater saying, who is James Edwards? Who is this black actor? He really, Sonny, was Sidney Poitier. Before Sidney Poitier, mm-hmm. He was there. He was right on the cusp of stardom. He was there. Handsome, suave, great screen presence. And now he has a starring role in a movie, but he doesn't get offers to be a leading man. And his career just sort of starts to simmer down and slide down. And he's very frustrated. He starts drinking. He starts dating white women. Studio chiefs are very upset by that. He floats around Hollywood. He does little small roles here and there. Finally, in the mid-60s, he moves to San Diego and he starts writing screenplays. Then he gets a call to appear in a movie with George C. Scott in 1970, and it's called Patton. And he is the military valet to General Patton in this movie. Movie comes out in 1970. By the time the movie comes out, James Edwards has died at the age of 51. A lot of sad stories about the struggle of black actors, and many die too young. And he's one of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
It happens all the I was at one point keeping tally. I mean, just the number of actors who die in their 40s and, you know, 40s. late 40s, early 50s. It was kind of astonishing.
It was. I mean, yes, you are right. And he was one of them. And I was just happy and then I could write, flesh his story out. And because he's one of many who died in the 50s, I mean, who flourished a bit in the 50s and then died far too soon. And as I said, he died in 1970, before he really seen how Blacks, you know, would start to have careers in movie making. You know, that's a struggle that still goes on, but things certainly got better, much better than when, you know, much better than when he started out.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Sidney Poitier, and he was like kind of the proto Sidney Poitier, but in your book, I'm misremembering, but I believe Sidney Poitier delivered the eulogy or delivered a eulogy for Edwards, right? At his funeral?
Not at his funeral, but he did say a lot of things about James Edwards when he died. And I think you're thinking of a moment in the book when Sidney Poitier is in LA and he's talking about wonderful talent.
Yes, yes. I have the quote here. This is Poitier. He says, all young Negro actors today owe him a debt of gratitude because it was Jimmy Edwards who started the employment situation outside of the old stereotype with his performance in Home of the Brave. Which is, I mean, it's as stirring a tribute as I think an actor at this time could get from, you know, Sidney Poitier.
Yes, you're exactly right. You are exactly right. It was very touching, you know, and it showed that link too, you know, that link between, you know, I think Sidney Poitier, he was cast in a movie called Red Ball Express, a war movie. And it was exactly the kind of movie that James Edwards might have been cast in if rumor hadn't got around that James Edwards was spending social hours with none other than Lana Turner, a screen goddess, a blonde screen goddess. And the studios did not like that. But, you know, she was a friend of his and he was a friend of hers and things just went haywire.
Why do you think it was that Poitier could make the leap and Edwards couldn't? I mean, was it just a function of society progressing a little bit more in the intervening years, or specifically, I mean, the rumors about his love life? Because it feels like we're right on the cusp here, and then there is a leap with Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte in the narrative of this story.
Yes, I think it happened, Sonny, and that's a great question. I think it happened, and because you had a few intense years, 1959, 1960, 1961, where you had Martin Luther King Jr. on the rise, you had A. Philip Randolph and on the rise, you had in the president in 1960 who got elected, who's starting to pay some attention to civil rights, you start having these rumors that there's going to be this march in Washington. Those rumors have been floating around all throughout 1961, 1962, and as we know, the march when Washington finally happened in 1963. So I think it was because Sidney Poitier, he came along at a time when foot soldiers were starting to march. People were rising up. They were tired of this Jim Crow nation, and they were starting to rise up. And you also had somebody who was very talented. Sidney Poitier was very talented. You know, he had trained on the stage. He knew how to act. You know, he was a very, very smooth actor. And it is, I think, very important to acknowledge that those early roles, Lilies of the Field, for instance, a nice fable-like movie where he played a handyman who arrives at a church and helps five East German nuns finish building that church. His race is never mentioned in that movie, never. And so Hollywood steered clear of race. That movie was important because Sidney Poitier, of course, became the first Black man to win a Best Actor Oscar in Lilies of the Field. He won his statuette in 1964.
I want to talk a little bit about before we get to Melvin Van Peebles, the recently departed Melvin Van Peebles, and the movement that he kind of kicked off and that I think is still resonating today. I want to talk a little bit about Porgy and Bess, which is a really interesting story here, both in terms of the musical, the Broadway musical, and the film adaptation of it, and how it has kind of disappeared, how it is not exactly a lost film, but a recalled film. It's a fascinating story here. I'll let you tell us. But what was Porgy and Bess, and what happened to it? Why can't we really see it anymore?
Yeah, it was a film set on South Carolina's Catfish Row, and it grew out of this Black opera that was written and staged by George Gershwin, there were many, many stage versions of it, and it traveled around the country. It really was the first colossal musical hit and that traveled in this country.
And beyond the country, right? I believe it played in the USSR.
Right. Yeah, it did. It did. And so many people, once again, and imagined Black culture through what they had seen on a stage or on a screen. And so the movie studio said in the late 50s, there's still a lot of people interested in this as a film. It's never been made as a film, opera, stage shows. It's still very popular. So we ought to make a movie. And they hired Otto Preminger. He was the director. And they got a cast, Sidney Poitier and Pearl Bailey, Brock Peters, Sammy Davis Jr., Diane Curl. And they filmed this movie, though. However, by the time they had finished filming, it was already dated. Mm-hmm. Blacks did not want to see another Southern dipped racist themed movie. Blacks wanted to see something more sophisticated. And the movie came out and it got lukewarm reviews. And then word had filtered out that the Gershwin family no longer wanted to be associated with the movie. And so in the 60s, the movie, it just started vanishing. And theater owners wouldn't show it. They feared that, and the family might sue them or something. Mm-hmm. And so the movie really, really simply went away for many, many, many years. And, you know, it's kind of the story of the last of the antebellum epic dramas that Hollywood made. It was an all black movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was mostly all black, you know, but it was sort of tinged with this sadness and with being out of date with the nation that now had many blacks starting to march and starting to move.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really interesting to read the chapter on this story and kind of how it went from being, frankly, at least this is my read on it, frankly, a fairly progressive, you know, Broadway theatrical production to being seen as a fairly regressive movie just 25 years later, 30 years later. Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating. Yeah,
you are right, Sonny. You are exactly right. When it first and appeared on stage, though, folks loved it. Oh, this is like new, this is great. The lyrics are great, the songs are great. You know, people were humming Summertime, you know, the fish are jumping. People were humming the tunes, you know, from the Broadway play and the operas. I mean, various stage versions, though, in the 70s and the 80s, certainly got better. I mean, they had more edge to them. They had more fight to them. But still, there was this big monster out there, and that was the movie. That was the movie.
Yeah, it's interesting. All right, so let's move on to the rise of Melvin Van Peebles, who I think, you know, there's a big Criterion box set out there right now if you want to if you want to get caught up on the work of Melvin Van Peebles, definitely should check that out. How did he become kind of the founding father and we can talk about this as well. I feel like you were slightly hesitant to use the word blaxploitation, which is the kind of the common usage for this genre of film. But he is you know, one of the great independent filmmakers, and he kicked off a whole movement. Let's talk about that.
You are so right, Sonny. I was a little hesitant to use that word. Thank you. You are spot on. Okay, Melvin Van Peebles, he went to college in the state of Ohio. So did I. I went to Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and Melvin Van Peebles went to Ohio Wesleyan. Anyway, he gets out of college, he goes to San Francisco, he starts driving a taxi cab, he starts writing short stories. He wants to make films. He can't get any headway in San Francisco. Friends tell him he might like to go to Europe. He goes to France. He learns the language. It's a very hard language to learn. He was a pretty smart cat. He starts writing short stories and novels. In French, he starts writing these novels and short stories in French. He is influenced by the new wave of French cinema. He starts hanging out on film sets. He gets a couple grants and he makes some small short story movies that were made from some of the short stories that he had written. And then he makes a film called A Three-Day Pass about a Black soldier roaming around France and meeting a French lady. That movie gets some attention. He gets summoned back to Hollywood. When he gets to Hollywood, he gets a movie offer, and he makes a movie called Watermelon Man. And it's a satire, it's a comedy. It's about a man who is white, who wakes up one day, looks in the mirror, and he realized some strange way he has turned black, and he has to face the world that way. The movie was a hit, and Melvin Van Peebles gets offered his second movie. He tells the studio he doesn't want to make that. He has an idea. Studio asks him what the idea is, and he says it's a film about a black man who is something of a lover in the stud, and he's in Los Angeles, and he wants to protest against police brutality, and he's in love with black power, and he smokes dope. So the studio must have looked at Melvin Van Peebles as if he was out of his mind. And they told him that they didn't want to make that movie about somebody who doesn't like cops in LA and who smokes dope and who sleeps with a lot of women who happen to be white. And so Melvin Van Peebles walks out the door, he's heartbroken, and he says to himself, I don't want this movie to die. And so he comes up with an idea that he's going to go around and ask friends of his for a little money here and a little money there and a little money there and a little money there. And he hires no-name actors. He has $500,000 to film this movie. He doesn't have enough money to hire a star, so he hires himself. He directs it and he stars in it. On a $500,000 budget, the movie ends up making $20 million plus. And so Melvin Van Peebles, in this short period of time, had shown filmmakers everywhere that if you believe in your film, if you believe in your script, that you can raise money and you can bypass Hollywood, because Melvin Van Peebles visited several cities. He hired a band later. I mean, the band was Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Yeah.
And they weren't known at the time. And so he went to black radio, black newspapers, into the theaters themselves on site. He would be there to the theaters. And at first, only two theaters showed the movie, but then it grew and grew and grew, and it became this great hit. And Melvin Van Peebles, who we just lost recently, he became an icon, following in the steps of Oscar Micheaux.
Right, right. And he, in turn, inspires a whole slew of films. I mean, you know, Gordon Parks, films and filmmakers, Gordon Parks and
Spike Lee.
And Spike Lee it's an absolute legend. Again, folks should check out the Criterion set if you haven't seen his films. I do want to just talk a little bit about the term blaxploitation, because like I said, I felt there's an interesting moment in the book when Julius Griffin is talking about his discomfort and distaste for these movies that I feel gets at a real debate in certain circles about, you know, the role that these films, you know, play in terms of public perception of African Americans and you know what the responsibility is the wrong word, but just kind of how it plays. Could you talk a little bit about that and your own personal take on this and how you see these films as part of the broader culture?
Yes. You know, when I was a kid in the 60s, and I would go to see movies, you know, and the stars who I saw on screen were John Wayne, Lee Marvin, Jimmy Stewart, Henry Fonda, Liz Taylor, Barbara Stanwyck, and there were Charles Bronson, Rock Hudson. All these people were, you know, on the 60-foot screen. And I, as a little kid, fell in love with them. They all had one thing in common at this theater in my hometown. They were all white. I never, and at the Garden Theater, saw an actor on the big screen who was black. And then I went away to college in the 70s and I came back home and there was another theater downtown. It was called the Southern Theater. And they were showing movies like Superfly, Shaft, Foxy Brown, and Buck and the Preacher. They introduced me to wonderful talents like Richard Pryor and Billy Dee Williams, Pam Grier, Yaphet Kotto, Max Julian. I mean, it was a whole world. And I think that moment between the 60s and the 70s told me that Hollywood had two different sensibilities when it comes to films, black and white. You very seldom saw blacks in white films, but you would see whites in black films. There was more interracial mixing in the black films than there were in the white films. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was fascinating, that even cinema echoed in a way how segregated this nation has been. Now, with the term blaxploitation, I do have a problem with that term. And I do mention it because it grew out of NAACP official who was upset that he didn't get in the marketing account for a certain movie mm-hmm. at the time. So I'm very careful about that. And also, on the for real spectrum, it did introduce a lot of black talent. If you just look 5 years earlier, there was not a cinema movement with black talent. It wasn't. So there was this very intense period between like 1969 and 1974, where you had a flourishing film movement with blacks. And I think it was extremely fascinating. It offered people an opportunity to get into the unions in Hollywood. And in its own way, it told Hollywood that people of all races would go see these movies starring blacks.
Yeah. Yeah. I really fascinating period in history here. Everyone should read up on it. I'm running out of time here. I'm running up against the edge of the limit here. There's still so much to talk about. The last thing I just really want to hit on here is Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. And when Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing comes out, there's this moment where several white critics and white columnists suggest, you know, oh, this movie's dangerous. It could incite violence. You know, we're worried about what's going to happen. And I want to use that just as a way for you to talk a little bit about the overall lens of criticism and critical thinking and critical writing, being essentially, you know, a white one. I mean, being essentially certainly at the very least not African American lens, and how that has kind of impacted how these films have been viewed, you know, both by audiences and historically, and how that has been, you know, how that has impacted filmmakers themselves.
Yes, I think Spike, I think he's a very fearless, wonderful filmmaker, extremely gifted. But Spike also is aware of this. 60 feet outside the doors of any movie screen is this nation, how this nation rocks and rolls every day, how the country hums. And this country hums with a lot of racial problems. And Spike has found a way to put those stories on screen. Now, when other white filmmakers put stories on screen in that show violence, and the critics don't say, well, that movie's dangerous, that movie might ignite riots. But the critics in the 80s and the 90s said that about Spike Lee. And it wasn't fair. I just think that filmmakers, if they can raise the money and if they can get the production deals, should make the kind of movies that they want to make. All filmmakers need heroes. All filmmakers need somebody who's going to champion them. You know, there are many white heroes in this book who have championed Black filmmaking. Recent example, I think that you have to mention Brad Pitt. His production company really cares about stretching their arms wide and to bring in all types of filmmaking and filmmakers. And I think that it is important. I mean, look, it's only been in the past year where we've seen TV commercials that have shown Black and white couples, married couples, interracial married couples. And so if that's only happened in the last year, it's fairly easy to understand why Hollywood has been so reticent and nervous to deal with race. And I think when you deal with race, there's been a lot of violence in this country when you deal with race, and it's still going on, as we know. And so cinema, you know, cinema has to entertain, you know, as you know, folks say, no business, no show, show business. Movies have to make money. Spike Lee's movies have taken on various serious subjects and they've made money. Now, I think we went through those two seasons, 2015 and 2016, when there were no Black Oscar nominees, and then that started the hashtag Oscars So White, you know, which is a sad part of the story, but there's also much triumph with these new filmmakers, new actors who are rising, Ryan Coogler, Michael B. Jordan, Ava DuVernay, you know, there is a lot of talent out there. and they need the opportunity and they need the space to be able to make their films.
Yeah. I always like to close the show by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything you want, if you think people should know about your book or the state of filmmaking in general. I mean, I like to see what I have failed to ask in my terrible questioning. But is there anything you think folks should know?
My goodness, no. I think it's been a wonderful show. I think cinema binds us all as a nation. And I've been a foreign correspondent. And I'd go into a foreign country and within a day of being there, somebody in France or Italy or South Africa would ask me about a certain film from my country. And so cinema tends to bind us all. One of the things I think is fairly, I don't know, lovely is the right word, but it's nice about this book is that, and you see this figure floating through the book a lot, and because he was a film critic, and that's James Baldwin. He's in this book a lot. He's always talking about movies in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And so it was nice to be able to give him his due as far as his knowledge about cinema.
Yeah. Yeah. James Baldwin, one of the great, not even really a film critic, just one of the great writers about film. You know, he just, yep. His stuff is always worth reading. Thank you very much again for being on the show, Mr. Haygood. I really appreciate it. The name of the book again, Colorization, 100 Years of Black Films in a White World. Get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever books are sold. I think it would make a great Christmas present for the movie lover in your life. My name is Sonny Bunch. I will be back again next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. See you guys then.